Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Telford, joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Hello.
And Josh Brown.
Hello.
Do you guys like old games?
Yes.
Yes, I love them.
Me too. I got an N64, and then Benji was talking about things that he plays from 20 years ago, because I can't get him to talk about anything else. And we thought we might as well just bring together a whole bunch of old school games that have aged the best. Now, this is just obviously a massive conversation. We've only picked three apiece each, because there are so many gems or whatever. So I'm going to kick things off with The Adventures of Batman and Robin on the SNES, which I hope you've both played.
No, because I was preparing for you to say, make sure it's not on there, Spider-Man 1 on the PlayStation 1.
I initially had that, and then I started going back through like my old childhood favorites and things that I've made posts about and whatever on social media. And then I was like, no, I want to talk about this because I haven't mentioned this. Yeah. But I've got it on my Mac as an emulated version and have it on the original SNES.
I have not played this, so tell me more.
It's amazing. So Benji, have you played it?
I have not played it.
Okay, so this is the Adventures of Batman and Robin. It's essentially just based on the cartoon with that old school like Batman animated series 90s. Style, art style. It's a fighting game, 2D side-scrolling thing. I just love it. I mean, I loved it a lot playing it when I was younger. Not on the SNES, but I sort of dipped in a little bit. Friends had it and whatever, and then I eventually got it back on the emulated version. But if you love the Batman animated series, it's got all the charm and the character, and the character designs themselves from that. And so it would be, you can just pick it up today, and it's incredibly responsive. A lot of those old games are. It's one of the, I don't know if it's like other than the whole thing where two people don't match on the same lane when you fight games like Streets of Rage, and you kind of stop missing punches. I find this to be a little bit more responsive in that regard. I think if you just have a base love of Batman, it's brilliant.
Is it better than Batman Forever?
Ooh.
I used to love that as a kid.
That's the one that has the Batmobile race, isn't it?
Maybe.
One of the movie games also back then had the Mode 7 graphics, where it was the first time they did like a 3D race level.
Was that Batman? Oh, yes, it might be. Maybe. I don't think it was Batman and Robin.
It looked like Outrun. It was that whole, like, the way that nearly all games did driving levels back in, like, 1995 or whatever it was, when it's just, like, one tunnel vision level. But one of the Batman games totally had that. Batman and Robin, Adventures of Batman and Robin doesn't have that. But it does have, like, just the general art style of the cartoon, and it feels like you're playing the cartoon, which, if you were ever a fan of BTAS, it's totally the best thing. So, yes.
I was just going to say, the big question there is, if you haven't played it, and obviously you weren't alive at that time, would you still enjoy it?
That's what I'm saying. I think it totally, I think, I think it's nice and responsive. I think that just in terms of just general, you know, how iconic Batman is or whatever, you're playing one of the best versions of that character. And just over the top things like Joker's Funhouse is one of the earliest levels. And the level design is just really inventive. Just visually, it's just lush. I just love it. I think it's the best tie-in, like, game that they ever did for the animated series. So yes, would be my answer to that thing. Benji, what was your first game?
It's a really obvious pick. It's Super Mario 64.
Shout! Finally played this gem.
Yeah, I mean, I've been banging on about this to you for the last
30 years.
Yeah, it feels like it. And 20 years? I don't know. I've really struggled to convince you, like, every plea, such as it's one of the most important games of all time. It's not aged a day. It's still just as playable now as ever. It's one of the best games of all time, but none of that's the same.
Your gambit was, I need to get an N64 because you hate the DS.
Because I strongly dissuaded you from playing the DS, simply because the great thing about Mario 64 and the thing that's aged best are the absolutely perfect controls, which on the DS was changed so you use the touchscreen. Mm. You actually got a really strange little nub, little rubber nub that you put on the screen and you had to sort of manipulate very awkwardly and unintuitively.
Okay.
Which is completely anathema to the whole point of Mario 64, which was designed around this beautiful new piece of hardware, the analog stick.
I mean, we're clearly going to clash at how beautiful the N64 controller is, but carry on.
I'll just jump in and quickly say that Nintendo's analog stick wasn't actually the first analog stick in games. I believe that was Sega's for the Knights controller.
Okay.
But it was the best, and it was the first up, was the de facto standard. Mm. And the way that they fine-tuned it was with Mario 64. Mm. And as a consequence, it's incredibly responsive in every direction, more so than any character I'd been before, and arguably more than a lot since.
I was going to say, because I've only had an N64 for about 24 hours when we record this, but Mario 64 was the game I got with it. Mario has this really weird sense of he leans into turns. He's got a lot of weight to him, I really love.
He's got an unusual turn and circle, and like if you press backwards, he doesn't immediately like flip around.
Yeah.
He actually has a turn.
Yeah, unless you let off the stick and then tap it again, you can kind of forward. There's little intricacies to it.
Yeah, that was so unexpected the first time I played. I didn't, like, you expect it to be perhaps, it's not that it's not sort of intuitive or anything, but you just expect it, or at least I did expect it to be more arcadey or simpler.
You have to keep in mind this was the first game to even explore with this concept of 3D space in this way, and it was before all the standards have been set much later, like what we expect, which is why it's a little different and why it's maybe not as, it's not what people expect, but it certainly works. And the thing you just mentioned there allows him much more fluidly lean into his other moves, like his somersault and his backflip and his wall jump, and it's not just a technical demo either. I think the camera is maybe a little bit dated, but that's down of the limitations of control more than anything. However, in terms of level design and the objectives and the structure, it also really brought that forward as well. Mm. And you really get the sense, it's not like just going back. What I will say is it's impossible to play it for 5 minutes. You can't think, I'll get the first few stats.
You have
to get all of them if you ever go back to it. It's just as mesmeric in 2019 as it was
in 1996. One thing that's really weird is having played a whole bunch of Mario since 64. I did play 64 when I was a kid, but it was literally because it was in a random shopping center. It was set up somewhere. I did a couple of levels. That was it. Never touched it until like the other day. But having played like lots of Mario sequels, I realized how similar or how much they take from 64. Like that sense of weight and momentum kind of carries through for Mario, but even down to the little melody that it makes when you get a moon in Odyssey, but it's a star in 64.
Well, Odyssey is its closest.
Yeah,
companion.
Which I think they were trying to redo.
Effectively, Mario 64 too.
But I want to, a very quickly little kind of thing to throw in is that, like, I don't know if you guys feel this when you go back to old games like this, especially old platformers, but they really have like a different way of making you appreciate 3D space. Because obviously it was groundbreaking at the time. They wanted to showcase, look at these 3D environments. But something like Breath of the Wild tap back into that as well, where you can climb anywhere and you can retake in this whole level kind of thing.
It offers so much more versatility to how you can approach the objectives. It also hides its secret well. If you play a modern 3D platform like Ratchet and Clank or even Spyro not long after, they are essentially on rails and you don't really have the freedom. It's in a 3D space, but you don't really have a lot of options in how you can approach the different objectives. Whereas Mario 64 made you consider what Mario's moves were, which you had from the entire beginning, and then said, right, how do you apply these to this space we've made? You can do it in any way you like, and everywhere is just as valid.
Well, that's the kind of the Breath of the Wild.
It stops you thinking about what you can do and more where you are. Makes you think about the environment.
There's something about like that little acrobatic stuff as well, where he is just doing little like side flips and triple jumps and whatever else. And like just that, like I said, it just makes you play, like you play in a 3D space.
Yeah.
And like, so that's what kind of
made
it
one thing I do
me,
as well is, you know, when you complete an objective and the star appears.
Yes.
I cannot bring myself just to jump into it. I have to do a backflip.
Well, there is that. And plus, when you go in the star, it takes you back out of the level, which, like, that's one little design flaw. Because you want to do other stuff, and it's like, now you're back to the start again.
It's a flaw in the sense, but it's actually a practical thing. It's because Nintendo wanted... Sorry, Josh, I'll let you talk.
No, it's just the
We were questioning where this is going.
I don't think this I'm
going to bring up another game which actually does this things differently, which is very similar, but I'll... conscious of it, but the reason why they did that is because they wanted the levels to change, but there was no way of doing it adaptably on the fly.
The only thing is, there's one bit at the very beginning, it's in that Babom Valley or something, and it's like you get on top of this little floating clump, and it's like, oh, here's the star, you got on top of here, well done, here's your star. And then they also tell you, wait just a minute, they always tell you that there's all these coins that you can grab, and then you go to get the coins, but the star's right there, and you get the star. I'll get the star first, then I'll get the coin. Back out the level, you can't do it.
You're talking about the red coins here?
Yes.
So,
the gold ones in the case of that.
Well, there's two things. One, you actually can get some stars out of order, which is very satisfying, makes it feel like you've chosen to go against what you've been told. And secondly, if you collect the 100 gold coins, it actually doesn't kick you out of the level.
Okay.
But I actually find those challenges the most fun because it really is a test of everything.
All I want to do is I want to grab a star and then I want to get cannon and fire through some of the gold coins. And I can't do it. What was the thing you were going to say?
Oh, it's just the thing about 3D space and that. I think when I was playing Super Mario Odyssey, because I'd been kind of... I'd become accustomed to games having one or two or maybe three ways of getting through a level and then that's it. With Mario Odyssey, I was so surprised to finish that game using really basic moves and then going online and watching people who have played Mario for such a long time
It's interesting. Interesting you mentioned, because in the Mario 64 community, one of the big challenges is, can you complete the game without jumping? Using just the B button. just for two reasons. One is an additional challenge to get more out of the game, and two is a proof of just what a great game this is and how much freedom it gives you, that it can actually be achieved.
Right.
It's not very enjoyable, but it can be done.
It can be done.
Dodge, what was your game that has not aged?
Well, it's one I've just finished this past week, actually. It's Metal Gear Solid 1.
Good.
It's the first time I've played it since I was a wee Ben. I played the others tens, if not hundreds of times in the case of number 2. Mm-hmm. But this was the first time I'd probably gone back to it and played it, which is a key distinction, I think, because Metal Gear Solid 1 is often remembered for its innovations in cinematic storytelling, and that totally holds up. But I was wondering whether the gameplay does... And it kind of does. It has a lot of problems that early 3D action games do, especially on the PlayStation 1, where the controls are very finicky and you have to wrestle with them a lot of the time, especially when you're fighting the Hind and you have to rappel down the side of the building. That took me ages. But it had something really interesting that we briefly touched upon in the last podcast, and that's its structure and its pacing, whereas... There's no real gameplay loop to it, although it is a stealth game. There are only like a handful of times you're sneaking around guards in a kind of freeform way. Everything else is sort of very structured to always give you something new, whether it's a boss battle or an interlude between like major segments or something where you have to like backtrack and collect key cards, which I absolutely hate, by the way.
That's the only bad bit, yeah.
It has a lot of problems, but no game is perfect. And I think going back to older games and seeing how dated they can be, this is a revelation in a lot of ways. Yep. Just the fact that you always have something new to do, and it's so tight. A lot of the games beyond the first Metal Gear Solid, I think, become a bit indulgent and a bit winding and a bit too focused on taking the control away from the player, whereas this strikes a nice balance between that cinematic storytelling and making you feel in control.
Well, I keep mentioning you guys, like, you need to check out the Polygon article with the translator, like the one person translator team, because that's the whole thing. The stuff that we fell in love with for the first Metal Gear, it's very much that one dude. It was a one guy translation team, which just kind of blows my mind. I think that, considering Kojima's apparent reaction to that was like, oh my god, you changed so much stuff. Even things like the codec came from that guy. It wasn't something that was in the script, but like, well, I guess the utilization of it was in the script. The name wasn't in there, and so Kojima was like, I'm having the final word on everything going forward, which is why they went way more off the rails.
It's surprising to me that Kojima doesn't recognize that the strongest thing about Metal Gear Solid isn't actually the story. It's the gameplay.
Benji with the takes. What do you mean?
I think the story is the one thing that's aged the most poorly between the first time I played it and if I play it now. I have no interest in all that.
Can I tell you
gibberish
about a hot Coldman and how he fits into the lore?
It was interesting going back to the story, because I think there's a tightness to that first game that lets it stand alone, but then it also kind of... Yeah, it has a lot of weird stuff about, you know, obviously the theme of it is genes and, you know, kind of like beating fate and beating like your fathers and like what your heritage is sort of already, you know, it's like fate.
And as we know, it's almost become the trademark of Metal Gear Solid is that it's chock-a-block of preposterous things that it treats completely earnestly.
That's why I love it.
I think it works really well in this game. I think it works more potentially as a survival horror game than it is an action game. When you're in Shadow Moses, especially when you're in like with the wolves and the radar,
the Grey Fox corridor.
Yeah, the Grey Fox corridor. You've got like all these ambient sounds, and the score is really steeped in atmosphere and horror. And it works as a not an action game, but this kind of weird horror-esque thing where everything is just unnatural enough to put you off. Like it does treat it with earnestness. But I think that's to its strength, because then it does unnerve you when these preposterous things happen.
What I will say is I do actually agree with that completely, because the first time I played Metal Gear Solid, it was the most tense I'd ever felt playing a game. Like, I really felt my heart rate go up to the sense of like being enclosed and being surrounded. And as you mentioned, some of the set pieces as well do give us a real palpable sense of
and
dread.
And like stuff like the Nikita corridor when you have to try and guide the missile like down this poisonous gas thing to free up that place to go. And then straight after that, you have the thing with Grey Fox and all the bodies and, oh my God, what did this and whatever. And like all the different, the whispers in the distance, all that, the weird little like sound effects. And at the end, when you finally come face to face with Metal Gear X and it's this massive towering thing. There is like a weird element to horror that never really gets talked about in that game.
No, there's so much variety to it. Even when you're just walking through the snowy fields from one part of the complex to another, and you might get taken by surprise by a mine or something like that. Or you can hear, again, the wolves in the distance, or even Snake's breath, considering other games at the time wouldn't have those little details in. It just maximizes the dread. Even mechanics that are never used after the first level or so, like people, guards being able to follow your footsteps via water and stuff. Like, that's barely ever used in the actual game, but it catches you off guard right at the beginning.
Yeah.
So you're thinking about it all the way through, which I love.
If you're on low health and you hit a mine, the take that David Hayter did when you die, where he goes, like just losing his mind in the booth at the time. That thing's just like seared into my brain. So the next game down that I've got is Def Jam Fight for New York, which my picks might be stuff that you guys haven't played, which I can just tell you about it.
Tell me about this.
Any of the Def Jam games?
Surprisingly, I have not.
I thought you would have done because you like the wrestling. You did anyway. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm for wrestling.
A little bit.
One of the wrestling editors on this very.
Yeah. And there was Def Jam Vendetta, which was like Aki Kaur, who they know in wrestling.
I'm
devs.
Not a huge fan of the Def Jam conglomerate.
But you've missed out.
Really in good. Fact, I don't have an opinion on them. I'm not familiar with the music.
Okay. So yeah, well, that's the thing. So the Def Jam label, they took all the different rappers and whatever, and then just what if their personas, what if their rapper personas, the overblown personas were real? What if they were wrestlers or whatever? And then invented a couple of people. There's this guy called D-Mob, who's like the head of the whole thing. That was in Def Jam Vendetta, which was more like a wrestling game. It was Aki Kaur, which are the devs of, I think, WCW Mayhem and a whole bunch of...
They did the two WCW games on the N64.
Yes.
World Tour and... Revenge, End of Revenge.
Yeah. So like you had like this kind of wrestling dev doing like just a bit, another wrestling game, but with these overblown personas. It was fine. I liked it a lot. But Fight for New York was when they made it way more like a brawler. And all of a sudden they brought in loads of environmental stuff where you could pick someone up and slam them off a wall and then slam them back down and hoi them up in the air and then jump up and do a drop kick or whatever. Not in like a Devil May Cry type sense. Everything was still very canned animations, but it was all by EA and the production for it, the sense of weight and momentum to all those characters. Like when you do a body slam, like a suplex or whatever, you really feel it in a way that I genuinely think no other game's ever come close to. Like, and they had matches in there called, I think it was called like a Hummer match, where because we only got one-on-one for this match, each person has a Hummer, like a, you know, a fully formed vehicle, and if you can destroy the Hummer by slamming someone into it enough, then you win the match.
That's good.
It's just great. And so you were just like starting people's faces off windows and slamming them into different parts of car parks and whatever else, and no other game's ever come close to that.
I'm really upset I've never played this, because wrestling games of, you know, doesn't matter whether they were WWE based or backyard wrestling. Yeah. I used to buy and play them all, and I'm really annoyed I might have missed the best one.
Well, I would say that this, because I said it, that Vendetta is the one that's more like a wrestling game. This is more like a brawler. You still have wrestling moves in it. Like, you know, there's still over the top stuff and everything. It was back when the EA Big
Label
was
massive. Very similar to Power Stone.
Maybe.
If you ever played Power Stone on the Dreamcast.
Okay.
Which is like an open arena brawler of the same
way. Can I kick someone in front of a train on it?
Maybe in the second one, but you can pick up pieces of furniture and throw them at it. And
okay.
It's like... It sounds almost exactly the same.
They had some environment, like, stuff that you could throw like bottles and stuff. They also had like the brawls that would take place in bars would be surrounded by like a crowd of people. So if you punch someone into the crowd, they would hold them. You could do like a tag team move with the crowd.
That's cool.
It never gets its due as one of the best fighting games of all time. And it clearly is. It was so polished. I think the problem is that after this, Def Jam Icon was the third one, which is clearly when EA was like, okay, we need to overhaul it. And they made a game where you dance to win. And it was just, you were still fighting, but the whole background would like pulse with the music, which is a good idea, but the whole way that you did finishes was to like do moves and then slam your foot down, like how Vin Diesel beats the dude at the end of Fast Five or whatever it is.
I'm hearing nothing bad about this concept.
I know, right? It sounds good, and then I bought it and it was horrible. So
I have a theory on the Def Jam Vendetta.
Go on.
Just I mentioned Power Stone a few moments ago. At around about the same time in the build up for Dreamcast launch, there was an AM2 game being advertised called Spike.
Okay.
Right. So basically, it was like almost exactly as you're describing, but like a real world beat 'em up where you like hit people in shopping malls and up escalators and cafes and things like that. And it looked incredible.
Uh-huh.
And then ultimately, it was cancelled.
Right.
Now, I was extremely interested in that game. I really wanted to play it.
Mm-hmm.
When Def Jam Vendetta came around, absolutely nothing on my radar whatsoever.
Mm.
And I think it's based on the license. I think because I wasn't interested in Def Jam, I just thought, nah, not for me.
There's something about, I don't know if you guys remember a game on the PS2 called The Bouncer. It was back when the PS2 came out.
No. So this was a Square's attempt.
The first trailer they ever did for that showed that it was like your standard JRPG character designs, but in more like a Western setting. And they were just like, it was like pretty much the subway scene from the first Matrix, but with four dudes fighting a bunch of randoms, doing like giant 360 camera motions in midair and catching things and kicking people in and do these different things. But then you go to the game itself and it kind of was like that, but without any of the style. There was no 360 spins, there was nothing at all. That Matrix influence was clearly just for the trailer, but Def Jam Fight for New York has all that impact, all that sort of just have fun with all these moves that you have, all these different interactions that you can do. I love it, Josh.
I'm totally sold, mate.
It's really good. So that'll be mine. Yes, Benji, what is your second game?
I might change this on the fly because it's very similar to the first one.
My God.
I know.
You have no respect for the rules, Benji.
I'm a rebel with
he submitted four games to a three request, but Karen.
I also can't count.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
I'm going to say Banjo-Kazooie.
Good.
Which is another game that you picked up with your N64.
I've got it. I haven't played it.
Yeah. So in 1998, it was a great bit. Which is better, Mario 64 or Banjo-Kazooie? For me, I like them both. Not wrong with that. And every time I play
it... Well, if you had to pick one, right here, right now, you have
I've picked them both.
You can't. You've got to pick one.
Well, I've said Mario 64 first, so just in order of precedence. But Banjo-Kazooie, every time I go back to it, I'm absolutely perplexed how smooth and entertaining and original it is. Right. The camera's better than Mario 64's marginally. It runs a bit quicker. It's ironed out some of the flaws. it's got so much invention, it just keeps you going throughout the whole game. But because it's so similar to Mario 64, it's difficult for me to really add anything more on about.
I think that's why it kind of got, I wouldn't say buried, but it tends to get overlooked when people look back on the N64.
I don't necessarily think it does. I think it's got a very, very committed fandom. I don't know if you saw a reaction to Banjo-Kazooie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not up there with Mario 64, even though people do
simply
do the
because
side by side.
I think because it was considered a clone. But I actually think it bettered a lot of Mario 64's flaws. Like, it doesn't kick you out the levels. They're all completely open-ended. Mm. Which, when I spoke about Mario Odyssey, we describe it as Mario 64 2. I actually think it's much closer and more similar to Banjo-Kazooie than it is Mario 64, as you will discover. Especially with the transformations and things like that. And also it's like littered with Rare's ageless humour. I know a lot of people don't like the silly voices, but...
silly voice is good.
Have you heard the...
I like to imagine Rare. I don't know who was doing it at the time.
Mr. Rare. Ian Rare was
Reginald Air. I believe so.
David Wise or Grant Kirkhope was one of the sound engineers there. Mm-hmm. And they all came and said, right, today, one of the stamps all came to them and said, today, I want you to imagine if a bucket could talk, what noise would it make? Right. And then repeat that over and over again. And then the next day, it's a palm tree today. Oh, brilliant.
I mean, it's a good way to go. Anything by Grant Kirkhope is some of the best music.
Well,
he contributed
to the soundtrack of Yooka-Laylee, the spiritual successor, which fell a bit flat because it tried to ape, that's a good rap. It tried to ape Banjo-Kazooie a little bit too closely, and I'm really, really excited to see what they come up with the sequel, which is going to be more Donkey Kong Country style.
Right, okay. That sounds pretty good. Josh, what is your second game? We're gradually running out of time.
Are we?
I don't know what time we started. I think we've been going for about 20 minutes. It'll be fine. But
my next pick is Resident Evil 1, and I know what you're thinking. Josh.
The original?
Josh, the original one. I know what you're thinking, man. You look at me like that, and you say, Josh, the tank controls, the voice acting,
the look of it,
the graphics, just the sheer look of it. How is that not completely
dated? I do
love it,
but
and that's because it's all part of the charm. It was back then, it is now. The tank controls are an integral part of that game's flow and that game's combat and that game's structure and that game's mechanical loop. And the voice acting was never good, but it adds to that B-movie aesthetic that it just thrives in. It is a scary game and has jump scares, but it's not just the voice acting that evokes that kind of like quirky kitsch aesthetic. It's the sheer look of the mansion with its blank walls and its oddly colored like floors and stuff. It's lack of textures, which works in its favor.
It totally works, yeah.
I think even though the remake, whatever version you get, is a better game because it does clean up a lot of its like mistakes. Mm-hmm. I think if you just go back to play Resident Evil 1, you can still have a banging time. And I did earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. See, the thing about the remake is that it retained the tank controls.
Yeah.
And it retained a lot of the things that gave that game its personality.
I need to do a whole separate pod or an editorial or something on the importance of tank controls.
Yeah.
Because I totally get why they went by the wayside. But there's something about weirdly, this will be a broken phrase, but there's something about not being able to effectively control your protagonist in the situation when you need to effectively control your protagonist that makes horror games really click.
Well, that's it. I think that kind of mentality.
You can't escape.
Yeah, it's been the bread and butter of especially those old survival horror games. And it's not just titles with tank controls either. Silent Hill 2, is he called James? James Sutherland controls poorly, even though you've got a fully like functional like 3D camera in that game in some parts. Mm-hmm. You still have the same trouble, you know, locking onto enemies, hitting enemies. Even in a game like Evil Within 2, your guy, at least at the start, can't aim for anything. You can't aim for toffee. You are purposefully underpowered in that way by making you feel a bit powerless in a situation. I think the tank controls add so much of that horror element to the original game. And just like the basic kind of the way you interact with the mansion and the zombies themselves, you need to really learn the layout. You need to know where things are. I'm a sucker for inventory management.
Okay.
I don't know if any game has done it better than Resident Evil 1, because especially when you're playing as Chris, you only get a handful of slots.
Prefer the limited stuff.
I prefer the limited stuff, because then you can't, even if you have a lot of ammo, because sometimes you can break Resident Evil 1 because it's slightly easier, you can get a lot of ammo, but because you've got limited slots, that is meaningless because you'll have to keep most of it in your item box anyway. So you can only take maybe one magazine full, and then you have to leave space for the other items if you want to do it efficiently, not have to keep backtracking. Mm-hmm. And it rewards you not only for learning the layout of the level, learning where you have to go, learning when's best to use your ammunition, but even what items you should take for certain runs so you don't have to keep running back, so you can do things efficiently. And it's kind of, I'm not going to say it's the same as Mario 64, Benji, but it encourages that kind of mentality.
It kind of is in its own little way.
You can play it in the most simplistic form, but you get more out of it.
The key unifying factor between these two games is that they both ask you to think. They ask you to step back and actually plan what you're going to do in the game rather than just going through it like down a tunnel, which is what a lot of modern games do. And it doesn't mean they're necessarily bad, but you do feel like you're on rails.
It's just that thing that the industry's obviously like sort of perfected or explored over the years of just tailoring the experience, like making sure that anyone who buys the certain thing gets to see whatever the highlights are.
So you were talking about the shooting in Silent Hill there. I was thinking back to the original Deus Ex. Because it's an RPG, it starts with JC Denton is shooting is all over the place. But people, if they approach that now, they're expecting it to play like an FPS.
Right.
And thinking, why does it never hit? Oh, the controls are bad. Well, they're not bad. It's actually the structure of the game to get better at it.
The nearest thing to that as a modern example would be that Kingdom Come Deliverance. Like, but you're meant to be this guy called, I think he's called Harry or Henry. You're supposed to be trying to avenge your family, but you've never fired a bow before. So like, it's literally, they take that to the nth degree where you're flailing around with a sword and you miss all the arrows. And progression's really good once you finally get it.
I was going to say, that was always a big criticism of Shadow of the Colossus, how unwieldy Wanda was, even though that was the whole point. It's not like he's coming in as a traditional hero. He's just a kid.
Yeah.
He was trying to save, I don't know, the princess relationship between them, but...
UK? Yeah. I forget her name. Mono? Anyway,
I don't know. I was going to say, for me, in games like this, even Evil Within 2, when you do have, obviously, it's a modern game, so you have an upgrade tree, you have leveling up, you can put points into, you know, sorting your accuracy out. Mm-hmm. Even when I was playing it, and 10 hours, 15 hours in, I didn't want to.
Right.
Because it would have potentially robbed something from the scares in the moment if I could accurately just pop people's heads off. I didn't want to do it. Eventually, I had to, because I had nothing else to buy, but I was purposely handicapping myself.
Yeah. It's much better if the game designs it so the player themselves levels up.
And grows better
at it, so you actually feel progression rather than just plugging a lot of arbitrary points.
Yeah.
Like, oh, great, I can shoot in the first one.
So you'd like to play a game with like really like loose accuracy, a really restricted inventory.
Only when
a sense of reward at the end of it.
Only when it's survival horror. I wouldn't play, if there was Gears of War and it was controlling like that, I would have a big problem with it. But because it's the Evil Within 2, in Resident Evil 2, for instance, as well, like that unwieldiness when it comes to shooting just adds so much to the in-the-moment horror for me. That Resident Evil
My last thing, I had Final Fantasy VII down, but Benji, you were going to have 9, so I ended up just saying the original 3D trilogy on PS1, which I can just kind of fire through pretty quickly. George, you're yet to play them.
I thought I was going to be a good fit for this podcast. And I come on and I realized I've played absolutely nothing.
That's good, that works, because I can tell you about it.
Yes.
Benji, we've played all the Final Fantasies.
We have, yeah.
It's a very good time. So I put 7 down. I've actually recently went back through 7 because of all the remake stuff. I was like, oh my God, I love this franchise. I'll go back to Final Fantasy VII and play it all the way through, like properly all the way through, because I've restarted it like endless times, but I haven't seen the back third of it until like the other week. The back third of that game is a complete mess. Because the translation team again was one person, but you don't think of that when you're a kid. It just all lands beautifully, and because the opening of the game is way stronger, it sits together. I still think that it's totally worth picking up. I think the characters are amazing. I think the world and the themes, like there's so many environmentalist themes that are really great too.
So what we're talking about here is how well have games aged and can you still play them today? I think Final Fantasy VII of those three people will pick up who've never had any experience of it, even a JRPG, for example. I think, what on earth is the fuss about?
Yeah.
Like,
I think you would still get it.
I think you could get into it, but I think it's I think you're going to have a much higher drop-off rate of people who just give up on it.
Probably. My whole thing, if you are about it, like, because obviously the whole point is stuff that you can still revisit today. My point was going to be that I think it's still open. I think the vast majority is still so recommendable. Because I played through with my wife and she hadn't even seen it before. And she still fell in love with the characters and the plot and all the environmentalist themes and Sephiroth being a complete G and everything else. And so I think there's still enough there that you can still love. I think you can still play it and appreciate why it was a big deal at the time. But the reason that I'm throwing in Final Fantasy 8 and 9 is that they only refined it going forward, especially in terms of storytelling. Because once 7 blew up, Square were like, oh my God, we do need an actual translation team. And so 8 and 9 actually make sense, with 9 having one of the best endings in the whole series.
The localization in 9 is fantastic as well. Like, it's so personalized and it feel like real people.
I think I would probably, if you're going to, because I would totally recommend that original trilogy. They're so long, like each one's like 40, 50 hours, but I'd still recommend them. But if you're going to grab one, it probably is 9.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. Like, I don't know anything about 9, but people like you guys.
The interesting thing about 9 is that it was originally designed as a sort of a guide and a side game, Final Fantasy, like, which would incorporate a lot of historical, like traditional elements of the series in one big celebration. Because 7 and 8 and 6 as well had sort of moved away from the old high fantasy setting to a more steampunk and then cyberpunk setting.
7 is really steampunky and cyberpunky. I love it.
So with 9, they wanted to do something like that. It was the firmament of Final Fantasy. But because they made so much of it and it was so big, I thought, let's just call it Final Fantasy 9. But as a consequence, it means it's a really great overview of the entire series as well, because it's full of references and all the hallmarks of Final Fantasy, which is pretty much all the series has now. Mm-hmm. but in addition to the fantastic gameplay of 7 and 8.
Plus, it's worth mentioning for 8, like, because for the longest time, there was a whole thing, which is fascinating, where like Square Enix had misplaced the actual code for Final Fantasy 8, so they had to go and get it back from someone they licensed it to once to bring it back or whatever. That was why 8 was missing from a whole bunch of the combination packages, the collections that came out the last few years. 8, they finally recovered the code and they're putting it back out now. But 8, though, like, a lot of people overlook that because it's like a Harry Potter style university for soldiers. And you just open playing as Squall, who's like just done a training. You'd love it, man. It's really good. And you have this whole thing where you're playing as this dude called Squall, who's been doing some training. He's been cut in the face and he's like waking up and they're just like, look, when you're training, you need to watch out what you're doing. You know, someone might be able to cut your face off. And you sort of just go forward from there and you know, you train to become a soldier and you just hang out in the dorms and you've got tests and you've got teachers and everything.
It feels so intimate, that stuff.
I love that. Yeah.
I wasn't necessarily the most popular person at high school, so I wasn't involved in all the social...
Screaming about Mario 64.
I wasn't unpopular, but I was just kept myself to myself. I was very quiet. So I wasn't involved in all like social aspects of it. So getting to replay of that in games always really appeals to me, as sad as that is. Final Fantasy VIII captured that at that time, personally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Final Fantasy VIII and Bully were like two games that I played when I was either in high school or in university or whatever. And there is something about games set in high schools when they're done well, where everyone has those memories of what it's like being there. And it's like,
does it really well.
Yeah, Persona's great for it.
I'd just say the problem with Final Fantasy VIII was that it wasn't Final Fantasy VII.
Especially
in this country when the previous six Final Fantasies hadn't been released, so people didn't know that they didn't follow on from one another.
Plus, it didn't help that they numbered them wrong.
Yeah.
But not to worry. Benji, what was your third game, please?
A really odd pick, because most people would say it's aged horrendously. It's not Banjo-Tooie, which is okay, but not brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's the original Tomb Raider.
This is a great one for the 3D space thing.
Yeah, and it's actually gone back on itself. So maybe if you played it 10 years ago, you'd think, God, I can't be doing with this, given what games are like now. But if you play it in 2019, as I just recently did, I picked it up in the Steam sale, you really, really grow to appreciate how little it holds your hand in its level design. What it asks you to do is you emerge into an area and it wants you to look everywhere, take everything in, piece those parts of jigsaw in your mind together, and then plot your own route through it. Mm-hmm. Now, the controls, people say it's ridiculous. It's so finicky. You have to like jump back a step and then run forward. I think that level of accuracy makes it better.
Right.
Because you really, really plan very intricately what you're going to do. And it always works. Mm-hmm. It never fails.
Oh, I don't know. I was going to say it's really finicky. I don't know about never fails. Everyone's fell down those chasms like a million times.
Well, but you don't if you do it properly. Mm.
I mean, but either way, I was going to say.
And also, realistically, okay, so you've played the modern Tomb Raiders where it's basically just Uncharted with a ponytail, and she's legging it through these environments, and you're not stopping to think. You probably wouldn't do that in those scenarios. You die 9 times out of 10. And a lot of these games you actually do, and it just puts you back in, so what? No consequence. Mm-hmm. In this, you would take your time, you would be careful, you would look around, you would think before you just leap. And then when you're absolutely sure, you take your step back, and then there's a sense
of. Yeah.
For breathtaking drama, and you grab on the edge, and it's like, great, I've made it. I solved it. Camera panning up.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That idea of like verticality, like loads of games do, like explorable environments. Nothing's done like peril when you're on the edge of this massive thing. You've just spent 20 minutes climbing at the top of it.
I don't necessarily agree with blind leaps of faith.
Right.
But I do think modern level design is too good to the point where, as well, if you play it, I know it sounds ridiculous to describe it as too good, but if you play a lot of games, eventually you become so good at reading the language of levels.
Yes.
You know what to do immediately.
Especially in games like Tomb Raider.
You don't even have to think. And yeah, it can be fun. It can be quite exhilarating, but you don't get the same sense of satisfaction or achievement.
There's something that in Naughty Dog's case for Uncharted, like they'll very minuscule. They'll slow down the set piece itself to make sure you're keeping up with it. But it's like something like Tomb Raider. If they did, you know, collapsing platforms or whatever in those original games, you would have papped yourself because you're already barely clinging on anyway.
And often you perish.
Yeah, well, yeah. You're gonna climb back up for another half an hour to get back to where you were.
Might explain why Naughty Dog introduced the wide linear levels in Uncharted 4 just to try and give it a little bit. Of a sense of openness.
That sense of like peril and like the thrill chase of climbing up like an old ancient tomb and not knowing what's going to happen. Yeah, I think they've lost that in the series going forward.
I'm really excited about this, Benji, because we've talked about this outside of this podcast, and I actually tried to go back to them at about 2012, 2013. I got them on the PlayStation 3, and I just thought, no, these have not aged well at all. These controls are bad. But with a few years on me now and with everything you're saying, I want to go back and give them a go because I used to play the original trilogy especially over and over again. I used to have the same thrill of getting used to the level and figuring things out for myself or getting my dad to help me figure things out for myself and then executing on that idea in the satisfaction that came from it.
The other thing is, once you're back in the swing, it feels very natural. because the control scheme was designed by a real person who playtested it. It wasn't just a random set of buttons that were just accepted. Mm-hmm. Like, it was designed to be like that. It is workable.
I would still say, if you're going to go back to Tomb Raider, especially for you, like, because the thing that pushed you away from it, I still would say there's a hefty dollop of finickiness.
Well, there is, but at the same time, the experience you're having is unlike any other game you're playing other than within that series.
I think it's justified, but I think like you can totally see why some people bounce off it, because it almost has tank controls, and like it does have tank controls.
It does, yeah.
And in terms of like rotating Lara on the spot and trying to take a minuscule step back so you can do the next jump or whatever. But that's kind of like the tank controls in Resi, it's conducive to the overall atmosphere and tone and everything. So it kind of works. What's your third game, Josh?
Oh, it's Angel of Darkness Tomb Raider.
It's
Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 / Pro Skater 4, because these games are just glorious. I don't know what Activision and oh my god, Neversoft were smoking back in the day, but they managed to get the feel of
the content,
the feel of skateboarding and combos back with those original Pro Skater games, and even into Underground to some extent, but they were never as tight as in 3 and 4, is my opinion. Just the idea, like the core gameplay of that will be ageless in my opinion. Like,
I think so.
Figuring out a level, figuring out the lines, the best way through it, nailing the tricks, linking everything together, just feels so satisfying.
That was like,
and it's great to learn, and it looks lush as well. Like, it's got a skateboarding aesthetic. It's early 2000s, late 90s, and it works.
I think, I mean, something like that, like, you compare it to, like, because you use your muscle memory, like, we all played those old games, and you do get so used to doing flips and grabs and everything. And then when 5 came out, they got it so wrong with the feel of it. And same with the Pro Skater HD remake as well, which I know they had to patch heavily to get the muscle, get the physics of it similar to what it was initially. But with 5, they made it so that the grind button is also a slam button, so you would just always, you'd get used to pressing the button to grind and just miss the pipe altogether.
Yeah, and I think that's testament to how well-oiled those earlier games were, because although they are deceptively simple, like you are just pressing square to do a kickflip, you're doing circle to do a grab trick, there's a perfection and a tightness to it that makes it just flow and feel and be so fluid and so elegant.
There's a secret degree of sophistication.
Yes.
To link in the tricks. No, just say we shouldn't really cast aspersions on Neversoft's extracurricular activities. I always wondered about Tony Hawk's 2. I never had the chance to play the third one, but I always thought that was a game that very much captured the zeitgeist of our generation.
Yep.
So I always wondered if that would necessarily appeal to someone of a different generation. Okay, yours.
I think like the rose tinted glasses or whatever, or just you. There's so much passion in those games. Like, it's as soon as Rage Against the Machine starts that opening cutscene, like, you're in for that ride. It is that time period, American Pie and Green Day and everything else. Like,
as you're proving, it isn't the aesthetics, it isn't the stuff over top that makes it so great, it's the fundaments underpinning it.
That's it, and I think that's what it lost as the series wore on, when we got into American Wasteland or even Tony Hawk's Underground 2, when it became so focused on the humor and the style and the culture of skateboarding as opposed to the actual skateboarding itself. And even then, obviously, it was an exaggerated, simplistic version
That dovetail into like Jackass territory. I was like, I used to love Jackass, but it kind of
A crossover between the two as well.
There was.
Like you said, it didn't feel like there anywhere to go. Like, what was the last Tony Hawk's game that you guys played? I think mine was Project 8.
Mine was 2.
Okay.
I never...
Number 2, or it was also Project 8?
No, it was Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2.
Ooh, wow. you went out on a high. That was a very, very...
Yeah. I played my friend at Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3, but I didn't have a PS2 at the time, so I never ended up getting it.
Did you play Thug, John?
I went right up to Proven Ground. I stopped when they started doing peripheral games.
Right.
But even then, like, Project 8 and Proven Ground, I didn't have the charm of the original, but they were decent 7 out of 10 games. You know, they were fine. They weren't complete abominations like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 5. I thought
5 was terrible.
Thug was an affront to me, because I can't say it properly.
Thug.
There was Thug in there. Skateboard, and it had Eric Sparrow in it, which is the greatest video game foil of all time.
You could also, you could climb stuff. It was then trying to be a little bit of a GTA. It was a cheeky thing. But yeah, let us know what you think down in the comments below about certain old school games that have aged the best. For now, though, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast, and I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Goodbye.
And Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.